Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and today's unemployment numbers were bad. Very bad. Worse than expected. According to the Labor Department, November saw the most job loss in 34 years. And according to University of Maryland economist Peter Morici, the threat of a widespread depression is now real and present. We want to just check in with Peter to start. So, Peter, let's get to it. You say the numbers are even worse than the Labor Department revealed, that the Labor Department numbers don't even reflect the reality, that the real unemployment rate is almost double what we're hearing, more like 13%.
Absolutely. A number of adults have left the labor force, if we factor those discouraged workers in. And also, many people are working part-time who state they would prefer to work full-time but simply can't find full-time employment. If we factor in those numbers, it's about 13%, likely headed for 20%.
You write that the economy will add jobs for college grads with technical specialties in finance, healthcare. We've talked about this, engineering. But how does it look for the rest of the landscape?
For the rest of the landscape, it's not very good at all. If you have a highly specialized skill, the job market will have a place for you. But if you're a college graduate with a degree in history or a broadcast journalist or a college professor and you lose your job and you need to find another one, you're going to be in a lot of trouble.
Well, the Boston Globe reports today that more and more men are finding themselves out of work, that this downturn is impacting men more than women because of the sectors they're in, construction, manufacturing, finance. In fact, women actually gained ground in the job field, in fields such as healthcare. Are you seeing that as well?
That's right. I mean, the fields that women like to be in, public education, healthcare, and so forth, they tend to be doing a bit better. Part of that is because of the insurance system we have and the fact that a lot of these jobs are government-funded, so they're less cyclical in nature. The other thing is, frankly, women are more flexible than men are.
Well, but I would think that if women increasingly become the breadwinners, that has an economic effect in childcare and all the other issues that women have to deal with.
Well, we're not yet dealing to that kind of social transformation, but if this goes on for 3, 4, 5 years, we will. We've seen this in manufacturing communities in the past.
You write in your new newsletter that a recession is like a stock market correction. It can correct itself without government intervention. A depression can't. So give us your laundry list of advice to get us out of this mess for President-elect Barack Obama.
Well, the first thing we need to do is we have to find ways to reduce our gasoline consumption and to do it rapidly. Building windmills isn't going to solve the problem. We have to move rapidly to much more fuel-efficient vehicles, hybrids, and plug-ins. The second thing is we need to put a tax on dollar-yuan conversion because the Chinese are subsidizing dollar-yuan conversion and making their exports to the United States. Those coffee makers you see at Walmart are arbitrarily cheap. We need to raise the price of those goods and make ours more competitive in China.
This is the trade deficit you're talking about. Americans are buying far more Chinese products than China is even allowing into their country. And China is, what, artificially ranking its yuan.
China's artificially undervaluing its currency so as to make its products cheap here and our products too expensive there. Chinese exports to the United States outnumber their imports from the United States by almost 5-1.
One last thought from you. President-elect Barack Obama has consistently said you can't have two presidents, and he has stepped aside, saying that President Bush is still in office. But yesterday, Congressman Barney Frank said Obama underestimated the number of presidents, saying we don't have two, we have none. Should Obama step up sooner than inauguration? Can he? I mean, what do you think should happen in the short term?
Between now and inauguration, the Obama economic team can outline the specific steps it plans to take to get the banks going again, to redress the trade deficit, and to deal with things like energy policy. It's not too early to begin talking about what will be done in January. After all, it is December.
Peter Morici, professor of business at the University of Maryland, reacting to today's pretty horrific unemployment numbers. And Peter, you say that it's capitulation. Do you at all worry about your language? Do you think you're overstating?
No, I don't. I think there's a real and present danger of a depression. The economy, if it's not self-correcting, will require fundamental structural changes, radical outside-the-box thinking, a la Roosevelt. He did things that were considered heretical by economists of his day, and it may well be that Summers and Geithner will have to well up the strength to do the same. If they don't, Obama's economic team will let him down, and he'll have to replace them.
Peter, thanks very much.
Bye.
Again, University of Maryland economist Peter Morici. Well, one night in 1964, the telephone rang in the Los Angeles home of a young David Walenchinsky. The caller warned that if he had a gun and was coming to kill David's father, author Irving Wallace. It was one of a number of death threats Wallace received that year because Wallace, a prolific and popular author, had written a novel about a black man who, through a series of improbable events, becomes president of the United States.
When I was a kid, 7 or 8 years old, we used to have this little ditty we all used to chant. If I was the president of these United States, I'd live on lasses and candy and swing on all the gates.
I've often wondered why anyone would want to be president.
That's my only unique quality. I never wanted to be.
That's a scene from the film version of Irving Wallace's The Man. It starred James Earl Jones as President Douglas Dillman. Well, with Barack Obama set to turn fiction into fact on January 20th, we thought we'd spend a few minutes today revisiting the late Irving Wallace's novel with his son, David Walenchinsky, now an author in his own right. And David joins us from the Village Studios in West Los Angeles. David, welcome.
Thank you very much.
This is really quite something. I mean, how often did you think of this, that your dad had this book over the past year?
Oh, a lot. And it was a very moving night. We had a party on election night. A lot of people were over. A lot of people knew about the novel. And when it was announced that Barack Obama was definitely going to be the next president of the United States, there were a lot of tears in the room, actually.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you, you know, about the reaction of the book and the time. But first, let's tell people what it was about. Who is the man in your father's book, Douglas Dillman?
He's a kind of a milquetoast character. He's a senator from a New England state. He's very soft-spoken, a former university professor. And he's the token Negro, as they used to say, moving up until he becomes the president pro tem of the Senate.
Yeah. And this is in the 60s?
Yes. The book was written, published in 1964, and it was supposed to be a contemporary novel.
Right. And how is it that Douglas Dillman becomes president?
At that time, the law was different. And what happens is that there are three people ahead of Dillman in the law of succession. The president and the Speaker of House die in an accident, and the vice president is very ill, hospitalized, incapable of proceeding, and dies. And so suddenly the third in line is the president pro tem of the Senate, and that's Douglas Dillman. So it's quite unexpected, and it happens overnight that he's president of the
right.
United States.
Can you read a little bit from The Man, the very large book from your dad? In the section where Dillman, now President Dillman, wakes up, his head is spinning. He's been sworn into office. It's the morning after. And into his head leaps the short poem, "How Odd of God to Choose the Jews." And and he applies this to his plight. Can you read some of that?
He remembered the short poem, "How Odd of God to Choose the Jews." He paraphrased it. "How odd of God to choose me, to choose one who had already gone high enough, too high for comfort, and had wanted nothing higher for himself, one who wished only to be limited to his legislative height, where reticence and diffidence would still keep him an unresented exhibit that was a sop to the liberal conscience of the North." Then the Chief Justice's wrenching words of the last night came back to him. "May the Lord in heaven bless you and watch over you as the first Negro president of the United States."
Now, Dillman later says in the book, "I'm a black man not yet qualified for human being, let alone for president." What was your dad saying about him?
What he was saying was not that he himself felt that he wasn't qualified to be a human being, but that that was the way Negroes at that time were still treated in society, that they weren't considered full human beings. So when he says, "I'm not qualified to be a human being," and suddenly he's, you know, leapfrogs up to being the head of the country.
And one can just really see this just in that paragraph, somebody saying, "Oh, no, the spotlight's on me." I mean, you know, with all that went with it in the 60s. And he's right in many ways. He becomes a figurehead. He's controlled by the Secretary of State and the Secretary of State's overly ambitious wife. But then, slowly, Dillman does assert his own power.
One thing that really moved me about reading the novel the first time, of course, I was a teenager, is that the night that Douglas Dillman becomes president of the United States, he's in shock, of course, and you know, suddenly he has Secret Service. They put him in a limo and they drive him back to his home, which is in the black neighborhood in D.C. And when he gets there, the streets are lined with people cheering, and he can't handle it. He races inside his home and he realizes he's not just himself, that he's a symbol. And in a strange way, I feel that that same dynamic is happening with Barack Obama. Of course, Barack Obama sought the presidency, unlike Douglas Dillman in my father's novel. But still, there will be no day in which Barack Obama isn't viewed as a black president.
Even though, as you're saying, that may be the least thing he wants. That may not be his choice.
Oh, I would imagine that, Obama would just like to get on and be president of the United States.
Right, right.
He's got a lot of problems ahead of him.
Right.
He doesn't have to deal with race, but it's always going to be there.
Well, and let's talk about how the book was received in 1964. Readers loved it. 34 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. But critics, in some cases, hated it. Martin Levin wrote in the New York Times that in any competition for worst novel of the year, Irving Wallace's The Man must be considered a formidable contender. What did your dad say about that?
My father was upset by this. He didn't like bad reviews. And in reality, I went back and it turned out that 2/3 of the reviews for The Man were positive. But of course, my father never paid attention to those. He only remembered the bad ones. And it hurt him. But he also realized that although there were some actually legitimate negative reviews that discussed his writing style, a lot of them just seemed to hate him. And it had to do with previous novels that he'd written. The Chapman Report, The Prize, which had become big bestsellers and made him a lot of money. There were a lot of book critics, including the New York Times, that just didn't like you to write popular novels and make a lot of money. That's not what a novelist was supposed to do.
Especially big, big books that Americans were snapping up.
Yes, yeah, they were resentful of that.
Yeah.
And, my father actually, he loved the fact that he was always getting letters from readers and that they liked him. But actually, that's part of what led to writing The Man. He realized that at that point in 1963, when he got the idea for writing a novel about a black president, that there were millions of people who would read whatever he wrote. And so he thought, here's my opportunity. I can do something with this good thing that's happened to me, which is that I've built an audience. And I can make a point. I can write about racial injustice. And that was actually part of what inspired him to write The Man.
That's David Walenchinsky, the son of the late author Irving Wallace, talking about the year 1964. His father's book, The Man, a fictional account of America's first black president, was on the bestseller list. Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions on the radio. These were heady times. We can take a short break. When we come back, we'll get David's reaction to the film version of the book. It was pretty much kept out of circulation. And also, a hilarious, if it weren't so sad, reaction from Hollywood to David's idea recently of making a new film. We're going to be back with David Walenchinsky. Also later, a surefire way to feel better about the economy, volunteer to go to Haiti to dig homes out of mud. Back in a minute, here and now.
Now maybe someday I'll reach that higher goal. I know I can make it.
Welcome back to our Friday conversation with David Walenchinsky about his father Irving Wallace's novel, 1964's The Man. In the words of the day, the main character, Douglas Dillman, is a soft-spoken Negro senator from New England. Given the token position of President Pro Tem of the U.S. Senate, constitutionally that would put Dillman in line for the Oval Office, into which he is reluctantly thrust after the President and Speaker of the House are killed in a weird accident and the Vice President is too ill to assume power. And David, you know, we have to remember The Man was published in 64. It's the same year President Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act into law. It appears civil rights were one thing, but some Americans weren't ready for a black president, even a fictional one. Yes, it was a bestseller, but we mentioned your father received death threats, hate mail, critics panned his novel. The Book of the Month Club refused to list The Man in its main catalog to avoid offending its Southern readers. There was a lot of that as well.
Oh, there was quite a bit of that. In fact, there was quite a story of making the man into a movie. Originally, there was a black screenwriter. He was very faithful to the novel. ABC controlled the rights, and they said, no, this is too harsh. We want you to take out some of the racial elements, particularly the white racism. And this gentleman refused, and Rod Serling came in and wrote whatever ABC wanted. And so the film, which starred James Earl Jones, was released in 1972, and it's a very, although it's still kind of moving, I saw it recently, it's a very soft version of The Man. It's not like the novel at all.
I have to say, in defense of my former writing teacher, Rod Serling, that he complained bitterly about how he was unable to make some of the social justice statements he wanted to make. This would be an example. I mean, it was watered down, but still, it does have an impact. We found a copy. It's hard to find because it had a brief theatrical run, was never distributed on video or DVD. But we do have a scene. This is when Dillman is shedding the puppet strings that were held by the Secretary of State at a press conference over whether he will extradite a young black American to South Africa, where that young black is accused of killing a government official. Let's listen.
President, are you suggesting, Mr. President, that this American, whoever he is, if tried in South Africa, he could expect something less than a fair trial?
Something considerably less, yes, Mr. Pierce. I think he'd be prejudged and officially lynched. Let me admit to you that in the short time allotted to me as president, I may never learn the subtleties of foreign relations, but several hundred years of history have made me an expert on lynching.
James Earl Jones as the first black president in the film of the Irving Wallace book, The Man. And David Walachinsky, we understand that you and your sister Amy Wallace had somewhat the same experience a while back. You just said this was a watered-down version, but you went to movie executives with the idea of producing a new version, and what did they say?
Well, we've tried for years and years and years to try to get The Man remade, but my favorite incident was when we met with some people who I will leave unnamed, and they said to us, well, what would you think if we had the president played by Tom Hanks? And my sister and I went, we looked at each other like, did she really say that? and we said, but Tom Hanks is white. He's not black. And they said, well, we don't think that The Man is really about race. And we said, yes, it is about race. Sorry.
And I bet they are kicking themselves now.
Probably so.
Well, now, in your father's book, President Dillman has two children, a son who's a radical, and this is the 60s, a black daughter who passes as white. So different issues of race in America are expressed through this family. But in the film, it's diluted a little. Dillman only has one child, a daughter, and she's the 60s radical who thinks her father is a sellout, one of those blacks that Malcolm X had a phrase for, who were sort of the Uncle Toms. They were subservient to whites. Let's listen to a scene.
Where on earth did I ever get the idea that you were honorable? You really must have conned me with your soft voice and your metaphors. Not honorable, scared. A privileged black man paying off and not having to live in the ghetto.
The house nigger, right?
Right on!
So your father, and to a lesser extent, though, the film, but, he really hit on a lot of issues.
He didn't want to deal in stereotypes, which was the way it was normally done when you dealt with black characters. And he tried to imagine and talk to a lot of people, what would it really be like if a well-educated former university professor became president of the United States? And what were the different aspects of the black community back then in the 60s? How would they react to him?
By the way, the phrase "the man," it had special significance in 1964. Remind us of that meeting, and what was your dad meaning in choosing it?
Well, he was quite aware of the fact that in the black community, the man meant the white man, the boss. Mm. And suddenly this black man is the boss. He's the ultimate boss. But there's also, yes, it's true, there's a personal transformation that Douglas Dillman goes through in the audience from being this kind of, quiet, milquetoast, background sort of person, where he suddenly has to take charge and, not let the other people in the government run him. He's the one who orders them around. And so in the course of the novel, he becomes a man.
Yeah. Did your dad think this was pure fiction, or did he think he might live to see it?
My father was very disappointed that he never saw a black person elected president of the United States. He wrote this novel. It was published in 1964. He died 26 years later. And he was really convinced at the time that he wrote the novel that within 25 years there would be a black president. And I know that I came across something he had written where he was very good at predicting the future in his novels. It was very strange. And somebody asked him, what was your worst prediction? And he said, the worst and the most disappointing is that I was sure there'd be a black president by 1990, and there wasn't. But still, I was extremely proud of my father for having written that novel.
And by the way, we've got an old, wonderful copy from the library, and it's dedicated to Sylvia, your dad's, you know, wife, your mom, David and Amy, his children, with love.
Yes.
Yeah. Writer David Walenchinsky, and we'll direct our listeners to your website through ours, here-now.org. He's author of The 20th Century, History with the Boring Parts Left Out, also a contributing editor to Parade. But we've been speaking today about his father, the late Irving Wallace, and his prophetic 1964 book, The Man, about the first black president of the United States. Very prescient. David, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Okay, all the news is next. Let's listen to a little more Curtis Mayfield, Here and Now. How's Haiti? The country has been so battered by past conflicts and weather that it's assumed that it's always struggling. But about 3 months ago, a string of particularly powerful storms devastated the country. Not one, not two, but four tropical storms and hurricanes within 1 month touched off flooding and mudslides that left hundreds dead and many more homeless. Haiti, you'll remember, shares an island with the Dominican Republic, and the boundaries couldn't be more clear. The Dominican Republic, lush and green, while Haiti has been completely deforested by bad land management and starving Haitians. That only compounds the problem, allowing mudslides to all but destroy cities like Gonaïves, which was left buried in a thick layer of mud. Mark Young, no relation, has just returned from Gonaïves, where he's been coordinating international volunteers helping dig out people's homes. Mark is with Hands on Disaster Response, HODR, a group that just sort of picked up and formed after the 2004 Indonesian tsunami, to mobilize volunteers after major natural disasters. They've been on the program before, and Mark joins us now. Mark, thank you.
Hello, Robin. Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, when you arrived in Gonaïves, beginning of September, what did you see? What did it look like?
Frankly, I was shocked. I have responded now to 7 different natural disasters since I started with Hands On, and the level of devastation moved me immeasurably. I was overwhelmed by the breadth and depth of the mud. The whole city was filled up with mud. They had a flooding issue, and then once the water receded, they had a mud issue, and it remains to this day.
People living on the roofs?
People still continue to live on the roofs. Part of our program is to help people dig out their homes, so it's very easy for us to identify people that need our help short-term because they're still on their roof.
I'm thinking of the scene from Fantasia where Mickey Mouse, you know, is trying to take buckets and buckets of water, you know, to get water out, and it just keeps multiplying. How do you address the mud?
That's actually a very good analogy. What we're doing is we're actually hand shoveling mud either into buckets and then creating a fire chain of volunteers, local volunteers and foreign volunteers, to move that mud outside of the dwelling. Or it gets put into a wheelbarrow, and the wheelbarrow is pushed outside of the dwelling. But there's many problems with the wheelbarrows because they become covered in mud, and then it's tremendously difficult to move the wheelbarrow through the mud covered with mud.
Yeah, I mean, and not only that, I mean, when it hardens, you got cement or, you know, something very hard, and when it dries, you've got dust.
The dust is incredible. The city of Gonaïves, for the most part, the major thoroughfares have been cleared by heavy equipment, and the streets are being filled back up by the mud that was in the homes, but in the interim, you have this very fine layer that gets run over by traffic, and that creates dust, and it's a very difficult operating environment physically because of the dust and then because of the weight of the mud.
It seems so Sisyphusian, the guy who, you know, rolls the stone up.
Yes. It's a tremendous struggle. The volunteers exhibit an amazing amount of energy and resiliency to get up every morning and go back out and face this task of moving the mud. There's been instances where we've achieved a certain level of cleanliness inside of a home, only to find out that the water table is still high enough that the home would fill up with water. So we've had to move through areas where their ground level is too high compared to the water table. And the volunteers are like, okay, we should be able to go back to that house now. The water table's dropped a little bit. Amazing, amazing energy. We had one house, by way of example, where we spent 15 days in this house, and it's probably maybe a 900 square foot house, and we had 15 volunteer days there over probably 1500 or 1200 hours worth of volunteer time to empty the mud from this house. It was the most severely affected house that we had. The volunteers stuck with it. Once they saw the end was in sight, they had this tremendous surge to get it finished. They didn't want to go anywhere but back to Olan's house. And we had a small celebration when they finished this job. I took a bottle of champagne to them and we popped the cork, much to the dismay of the neighbors. They didn't really understand that, but it was good fun.
Well, but I'm wondering, you know, you might be back there next year doing it all over again. I mean, this is a country that is so dysfunctional. We've reported on President Jean-Bertrand Aristide leaving in 2004. Former President René Préval was elected and has been said to be ineffective. All of Haiti is deforested. Do you find yourself, you know, lifting the bucket and saying, this is not, I mean, the answer has to be trees and a functioning government and food for the starving children, and I'm walking with a bucket.
The needs are tremendous. And what we look at as an organization is we look at what we can do. And right now, our organization sees people that aren't able to live in their home. So we can address that. The long-term needs in Haiti are tremendous, but our organization can fill a small niche need.
We know another thing you're doing. I just want to touch on this. David Campbell, who is one of the co-founders of your group in 2005, he was on the program when the group just kind of up and went off to respond to Hurricane Katrina. And we know he came into all of this from his background of high technology. We understand that the group continues to use high technology to at least try to coordinate work in Haiti.
Right. It is sort of one of the precepts of what we do is to try to bring the internet into the disaster area. And we've had tremendous success with using our website as an information source. It's a black and white information source. There's no bias. It's basically, here's what we see. Then if there is a deployment where we're calling in volunteers and asking them to come and help in the recovery phase, that information is put up via the website. Right now at our base in Haiti, we don't really have running water and we don't really have electricity, but we do have a generator. And when that generator is running, we have an internet provider, which is pretty amazing. And it was the same in Bangladesh and it was the same in Peru and in Indonesia. That dissemination of information, that use of technology to spread the word, so to speak, is a tremendous asset.
That's Mark Young. He's Director of International Operations for Hands-On Disaster Response, as you just heard, using high technology and GPS along with, you know, hands-on buckets to respond to international disasters. He's going to be heading back to Gonaïves, to Haiti, in a few days. But I'm just wondering, you're leaving the U.S. where, you know, everybody's just wringing their hands, justifiably, you know, over unemployment and the tanking economy. But you're heading to Gonaïves, your thoughts?
It is very difficult because the published population numbers of unemployment are around 70% in Gonaïves. And one of the confounding things of being there is the cost of living is so high compared to the level of poverty that it's really incomprehensible how the people get through each day. And when I Twitter or when I blog or when I talk to my friends, I refer to where I live or where my domicile is the land of plenty. And even though you have extremely challenging times right here now in the United States, there's a very close neighbor who has really unfathomable challenges in front of them.
Mark, thank you so much for talking to us.
You're welcome, Robin. Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, in fact, if you're interested in volunteering or learning more about hands-on disaster response, go to our website, here-now.org. Fascinating group. They also enterprise the use of GPSs in this kind of work, finding where the hardest hit areas are, letting the UN know about it. Just a fascinating group. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, today's grim unemployment numbers would come as no surprise to low-wage workers trying to make ends meet while hoping to hold on to their jobs. Here Now's David Boeri traveled to Athol, Massachusetts, in the central part of the state. It was once a manufacturing hub. Now it's economically depressed. And David checked in with people taking the bus to work.
From an old station where trains no longer stop, David Nowers starts his bus run through the town of Athol. On the banks of the Millers Rivers are the old factories that made machines and tools that once brought trains and people and jobs. People called this Tool Town, and through the water gates under the Starrett Tool Company, the river still roars, but the other factories don't.
We're going to the YMCA bus stop, pick up a passenger that's going to work at the Providence Cliff Nursing Home.
Through federal grants designed to revive a depressed economy, a nonprofit transit company provides door-to-door bus service for a dollar and a half each trip.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
Get aboard, dial a ride, and you're likely to hear the stories of working people who make low wages and don't have cars.
They live from paycheck to paycheck, the best way they know how. They try to get more hours and stuff like that to make it work better, but it's a tough area. There's not a lot of work here.
Hello.
Hi there. How are you?
Good, thank you.
You brought me something to eat. Not me, huh?
Melva Denault steps onto the bus in front of her home, where she's been waiting to go to work at Quabbin Valley Healthcare.
Most of my life, I've been taking care of the elderly, which I deeply love.
A certified nursing assistant, she works on the Alzheimer's unit. Her experience is long. Her finance is short.
My car isn't working so good right now. Unfortunately, on the wage that I make, it's taken me a little while to get it all fixed.
At near minimum wage, Melva says she needs to earn 10 hours or so of overtime a week.
Could you do this without overtime?
Probably not. But at this moment, they have cut our overtime.
Melva is 56 years old. She lives alone since she lost her husband a couple of years ago.
How long do you think you'll be working for?
As long as the good Lord blesses my hands and my legs. I'll keep going every day.
Do you have a pension?
No. No, I don't. I did. But I used it to pay oil and to pay whatever I needed.
This is after your husband died?
Yes. Yes, to pay for his funeral.
Up in the hills of Athol, the bus collects men who are heading for the night shift at one of the factories and warehouses in the industrial park in Orange, where many of the jobs are temporary with no benefits.
We both go on the main building?
Yeah.
We pass the Thomas and Betts building. It closed last summer. We pass empty warehouses. We pull up to MVW Inc., and two men get on after finishing the day shift.
This one, Athol?
Yeah, how are you, Steve?
I'm doing all right.
Stepping up after Steve is Kasim Abdik, and when he hands over a 20 for a $10 book of tickets, the bus driver jokes that he must have won the lottery.
I usually buy two, but who knows what the way things are going over here.
Yeah, really.
Things are a little uneasy right now.
How many got laid off today?
20.
Yeah, and all the temps are gone.
20 people got laid off today?
I think I'm together.
All day they've been making and packing wrapping paper for parties and presents. Kaz works the machines.
This skilled work?
You kinda, sorta. Most of the time you run around, a monkey could do it, I guess.
Do you get paid better than monkeys do?
Oh, yeah. Well, no, those ones that smoke in a circus, they must get a lot.
They say the average is $8.50 to $9 to start. Before this, Kaz made children's toys and caskets.
I worked there for 20 years. I wasn't making $10 until the last year. And now I'm making $10 over here.
To get a better job, you have to travel either 15 miles to the east to Gardner or 25 miles west to Greenfield. But for those jobs, you need a car. That's why Kaz is on the bus, the lifeline of the working poor in Tool Town.
Here Now's David Boeri in Athol, Massachusetts. And a quick heads up, on Monday's show, an activist in Miami sees lots of empty homes in foreclosure and a lot of homeless people. His solution? Move the people into the homes. Also next week, behavior economics. Why do people, for instance, shell out money for medicine and then they don't take it? We'll talk about that next week as well. Back in a minute, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back to the jungle. In 1987, Guns N' Roses welcomed everyone to their jungle. Their mega hit album, Appetite for Destruction, is one of Rolling Stone's 500 greatest albums of all time. But over the following 10 years, all but one of the band members who made that album left. And though lead singer, songwriter, and founding member Axl Rose kept the band name and kept promising a follow-up to the 1993 album, The Spaghetti Incident, fans were left hanging for 15 years. But now, Guns N' Roses, or more appropriately, Axl Rose, has released Chinese Democracy. Was it worth the wait? Well, here to talk about that and about other very loud blasts from the past that now come back to top the album charts, here now is pop and hard rock culture critic Renee Graham. Renee, thank you. You've brought rock and roll.
Hello, Robin.
And welcome, as always. Yeah, we have to ask, 15 years in the making for Axl Rose, so what do you think? Was it worth the wait?
The short answer is no.
Oh.
No album can possibly live up to 15 years of hype. And after that long, you know, if this album didn't cure the tendonitis in my shoulder, it just wasn't going to be any good, you know. But, you know, it's a serviceable album. It's just not a particularly memorable one. You know, we can hear a little bit of another song here called Shackler's Revenge.
Well, Renee, is the problem that, yes, it's Axl Rose, but it's really not Guns N' Roses? I mean, so many of the original members left.
Essentially, this is an Axl Rose solo album, because what you have on this album is called Guns N' Roses, but what you really have is Axl Rose, his unchecked ego, and a bunch of hired hands. That's not Guns N' Roses, and it really shows. There was really no one to rein him in, and so many of these songs are just tweaked and worked to death. It's just there's not enough there.
Okay. Well, there are other 80s radio names releasing CDs. Let's take a look at AC/DC. Their new CD, Black Ice, topped the album chart in November. Remind us about the band.
This isn't just an 80s band. This is a band that began in the 1970s. You know, they are the last of the great blues-based hard rock bands. They've changed lead singers. The original lead singer, Bon Scott, died in 1980 or so. Brian Johnson took over, and they've never missed a beat.
Well, let's listen. Well, that's Rock and Roll Train from Black Ice, the new AC/DC CD.
And the minute you hear that riff, you know exactly who it is.
Right, because let's listen to some old AC/DC. This is You Shook Me All Night Long. Yep, they pretty much stay true.
They've essentially been making the same song for 30 years, and there's a real beauty in that. There's really something to be said for a band who knows who they are happy with what they do, and they don't feel the need to change anything. There are no hip-hop remixes, there's no new metal, there's no political message. It's just AC/DC, partying, women, and the glory of rock and roll.
Okay. Well, the third CD that we want to touch on is one that it surprised a lot of people when it topped the charts in September. This is Metallica's Death Magnetic. Okay, remind us, Metallica, who are they?
Metallica, a band that's been around more than 25 years, came out of San Francisco, pretty much the kings of heavy metal. You know, no one else comes close. They've been doing it an awfully long time. And we can get a little bit from their first album, Kill 'Em All, which came out when they were just kids.
That was in 1983. This is Seek and Destroy. Stand in the scene, in the city tonight. We're looking for you to start up the fight. There's an evil feeling in our brains, but it's nothing new. You know what drives us to say. Running on our way out. Now we're awake. Okay. And the new Metallica CD, That Was Just Your Life. Listen to a little of that, too. Like a siren in my head that always begs to repeat. Like a blind man out of church into the beating drum. I think like a face that lets us speak when all I knew was how to fight. Like a misery that keeps me focused though I'm on a straight. Like an endless hammer that I must awaken from its state. Like a picture of premonitions. Not worthy of so I deny. So, Renee, what do you think?
This is an epic return to form for Metallica.
Ah.
This is the first album in 5 years. The last album, Saint Anger, was pretty much universally disliked. The band sounded a little lost, a little aimless. This is the band getting back to its roots, which is just big, bruising, brawling rock music. This is music so heavy and so hard, it can reverse your blood flow.
You've also said, you know, God bless Metallica, as dopey and potent as ever. So you get it that there's this mix of they really are supercharged, but kind of
But, I mean,
silly.
You know, there's this thing at this point. I mean, all of Metallica's members now are in the mid-40s. They're all multimillionaires. So you've got, you know, James Hetfield, who's the lead singer and really the leader of the band, who is, again, this middle-aged millionaire rock star embracing his angry adolescent again.
What's he angry at at this point?
He's always angry at something, you know, but he's loud and his voice sounds great. And the lyrics are always a little dopey. It's always kind of dark and weird, but it hardly matters. It's about the sound and the power. It's all sound and fury here.
Why do you think this is happening now? Metallica's first album in 5 years, AC/DC's first in 8, and Guns N' Roses' first studio album of original songs in 17. Why now?
People want to rock. There aren't a lot of really big arena bands out there anymore. You know, you certainly have rock bands like Kings of Leon, but nothing with that big stadium sound. You just have that huge wall of sound coming at you in these, you know, these epic songs and all these big guitar solos. You know, everything got kind of short and easy and radio friendly, and these songs aren't radio friendly. This is Metallica back in the days when radio wouldn't touch Metallica. This is back to their Ride the Lightning and Master of Puppets days.
Will we hear this on the radio now?
Not a lot of stations. First of all, you know, there's not really a song on the album that's less than 5 minutes long, and then there's, you know, not all the songs have tons of lyrics. They have huge guitar solos. This isn't what radio plays. Radio plays, you know, maybe 3 or 4 minute songs, so they're not going to play it, but it hardly matters. The album sold nearly 500,000 copies on its first week.
Well, we'll have a list of the CDs that Renee Graham has been talking about today. Meanwhile, what should we go
Metallica,
out on?
Metallica, the best of the three albums, certainly Metallica's, and I think we should go out on All Nightmare Long.
Some hard rock favorites making music news this fall. With Here Now's pop culture critic Renee Graham. Renee, for those who thought they were endangered, they're still alive.
Not at all. Rock and roll lives in its own way. It might be a little grayer than it used to be, but it still rocks as hard as it ever has.